today, I'd like to talk about the three A's, greed, hatred, and ignorance, or the three poisons. If they don't seem to be the three A's, we'll come to that later on. The terms greed, hatred, and ignorance crop up repeatedly in Buddhist literature, and in our own book of readings, we come across them at least twice in the purification and the great vows for all. So in the purification, we, among other things, say, all the harm and suffering ever created by me since of old on account of my beginningless greed, hatred, and ignorance. And the same three terms surface in the great vows for all. Greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, and we vow to abandon them. So I'd like to take a little closer look at those terms, both historically and perhaps more importantly for what they may mean to us, or certainly mean to me. Now, I have a bit of an obsession, as many of you have realized by now, with going back to original texts when I can find them. And I'm hardly an expert in reading Buddhist texts, but I do have a background in classical Chinese, which enables me to make some guesses about what perhaps they meant in the original Chinese context. And then were of course modified as they spread out through the Sinocentric East Asian and world. I was just reflecting on this. Thoughts came, and actually pictures came into my mind that I never quite realized. What is it about the connection, at least that I feel, to those texts? And I got two very strong images. I was fortunate enough, probably 10 years ago now, to go on a tour of Zen monasteries and temples in southern and central China. And as I sat there before, I felt this strange connection with two of the people that we refer to and to whom I think I owe a debt of gratitude. One, a Bodhidharma. So we visited the site, supposedly, you know, where he landed from India and began to disseminate. So Chinese Zen, that form of Buddhism, really owes its origins in many ways, or at least the received wisdom we have to Bodhidharma, you know, traveling overseas, you know, overseas and landing near Guangzhou in China. And then, perhaps more importantly for me, visiting the temple where the sixth ancestor, Hui Nung, supposedly inscribed or had inscribed a famous poem about the mind, which was a rejoinder to someone else's poem about the mind, which is mentioned in the Platform Sutra, and was able, there's a grand new temple or newer temple there, and it's sort of buried off on the side. There's this tiny little decrepit one, which I imagine was not really the original, but may have been built on the site of the original. So I was sitting there just thinking, you know, these guys have handed us something really important, and we're just, you know, another link in this chain, and it's gonna proceed beyond us as well. So to be able, for me, there's a kind of resonance with those old texts, which are really, really quite old. Perhaps more importantly, for me, I want to do my best to make these living texts as well. And I find some of the language sometimes a bit off-putting or inscrutable. And sometimes by going back to the originals, I find a little bit of clarity, and I'd like to share some of that on these particular terms that we're talking about. Bearing in mind, of course, that Zen advertises itself as the transmission beyond words. So to get too caught up in words, that's my problem, can also be a trap. So I think, as Zhuangzi, the Taoist philosopher, said, I think something to the effect of fish traps are to catch fish, and once you've got the fish, you don't need to trap anymore. So maybe it's the finger pointing to the moon or something like that. The words are a way of beginning, maybe getting into things, but of course they're not the be-all and end-all, which is the way we live our lives. I also found what my thoughts on this are somewhat contradictory, but that's perfectly Zen, it seems to me. On the one hand, I want to preserve these terms. On the other hand, I'm going to offer a kind of different translation, at least in one of the contexts of them. So if we go back, first of all, I was surprised to find when I went back to these two texts where I could find the Chinese for them, that the terms greed, hatred, and ignorance appear in one of them and not the other one. So, is this conspiracy, somebody trying to fool us or something like that? So if we go to purification, what we're doing is acknowledging the harm and suffering we've caused because of our greed, hatred, and ignorance. They're spelled out. And these are quite legitimate translations. They're other ones of those three terms, greed, hatred, and ignorance. And they do appear in the original text in as three separate things. And they seem to be sourced. The next line talks about action, speech, and thought. So our bodily actions, what comes out of our mouths, the word, and what kind of thoughts, what kind of intentions we have. There'd be slightly broader ways of looking at that. I do think that the most contentious of those three terms, greed, hatred, and ignorance, in translation is ignorance. In the original, it seems to carry a connotation of madness or delusion. It seems to be somewhat stronger to me than ignorance, I don't know. It's about almost a will. There's something a little bit more to it. But basically, those translations seem to work pretty well. But we go to great vows for all, and we get this three-part breakdown, and find it doesn't exist. The three things are not enumerated in the original text. And instead, we get a catch-all term that may refer to the original Sanskrit klesha, and I don't know anything about Sanskrit, but which refers, according to the Princeton Buddhist Dictionary of Buddhism, mental factors that disturb the mind and incite unwholesome deeds of body, speech, and or mind. So those three poisons come up again. But they're not spelled out in the great vows. And I just happened to, leafing through the internet, you can't quite do that, came up against an article by Robert Aitken Roshi in which he takes responsibility for that translation. And that's been handed down. I don't know exactly what the relationship, except through Jeff, of course, we know the relationship with the Diamond Sangha, but I don't know with Joko Beck, if there's a similar thing. Anyway, that's the root of the great vows for us. And what Aitken Roshi did was try to clarify the more general term about these disturbances, these unwholesome factors, in line with accepted Buddhist tradition by naming them these three things, greed, hatred, and ignorance. So it's not as though he's trying to trick us or to change anything. He was trying to elaborate. And it was part of three changes. A very interesting article in Tricycle about how he came to grips with the great vows. Well, he and the Sangha, so it sounded like there were lots of discussions. How should we translate this? How should we translate that? And that he's made several choices, which seem quite logical and reasonable choices of how to render them into English. So this is sort of interesting in itself, and for the pedant in me, that's probably enough. You say, it's Aitken's fault, But of course, the main thing is, what does that mean for us today? So I don't see any need to try to retranslate those terms, but I think maybe it gives us some latitude in how we interpret them, that they're sort of a precedent of a very, very knowledgeable, teacher who's done that. And those terms have sort of bothered me. Maybe it's because I'm not in touch with my innermost vices, but I don't see myself as particularly greedy or hating or ignorant. But I do see something similar, very easy to see in myself, their qualities. And I think at one point Jeff had talked about apathy instead of ignorance, and that prompted me to think, and I've come up with the three A's. So instead of greed, attachment, instead of hatred, aversion, and then apathy instead of ignorant. So I've got my three A's out of these unrelated terms, and maybe that's a mnemonic I can remember better. To unpack those, of course, attachment is the second of the four noble truths, so really, really basic. That's the cause of suffering. So we get attached to things, to ideas, to people, to ways of doing things, to self-images, how we relate to the world, sources of pleasure where we get attached to. It's very easy to get attached to a lot of things. Aversion, of course, is the flip side of that, and that reading this morning from Joka was very interesting in terms of avoiding unpleasantness. So this is aversion, and she unpacked that really beautifully, I thought, in that excerpt that we have in our collection. And then apathy, and this is the trickier one, the ignorance apathy kind of thing, but it seems has a connotation of a more active connotation than ignorance, of not caring, of being indifferent to what others may be experiencing, or maybe even willfully not knowing, you know, I'm just going to turn my back to this kind of thing, or the result of delusion. So we might not want to know much about homelessness or human rights abuses or the source of the food I eat or things like that. It's very easy for me to ignore, and that's willful. So I'm fairly carnivorous. I can't justify that in any way. So is that apathy? Is that ignorance? Is that, you know, I don't know. But, you know, there are lots of things like that, I think. There also are two dimensions, it seems to me, to these phenomena. One is the personal one, and the other is a collective one. So that I can see things in myself and in other people that relate to the three A's, if we want to use them, or greed, hatred, and ignorance, if we don't. But they can also appear collectively in larger groups of people, or perhaps whole societies sometimes, these same things. There's a very interesting piece on the website of the Rochester Zen Center, which was written in January at the time of the changeover in the American presidency about the storming of the Capitol. And to what extent was this a delusion? How and that poses real problems. How it's hard enough to deal within ourselves, or perhaps one-on-one with a friend, but you know, what's the situation when you're facing a QAnon bikie or something, and, you know, ready to trash the Capitol? So it seems to me it exists on both these personal and sort of broader planes. What do we do about it? That's, of course, the main thing. The antidotes are probably pretty simple to say, to do, or another thing. So awareness is, of course, the first point, followed by, I would suggest, following the opposite attributes. And we've got some good guidance from the Paramitas on that, actually, that we're discussing for those of you who are participating in those discussions. At the Rochester Zen Center, I misattributed the collective action one. It's got the quaint name. It's a place I know in New England called Red Loaf Mountain. Zen community, I think they are. And they seem to have a theme for the year. Peace was the one for last year. And so they're obviously very, very troubled by what was going on in the United States, too. So Rochester Zen Center suggests we start, obviously, with awareness. And I thought it's put very nicely by their teacher. By far the best all-purpose antidote to the three poisons is awareness. Take the case of anger. Our tendency when gripped by enmity toward another is to get so focused on him or her that we forget ourselves. We're absorbed by the object of our ill will. If we're not venting our accusations aloud, we're silently plotting our retaliation, rehearsing our comeback, or just awash in judgmental thoughts. We're so riveted on the other that we're not actually conscious of being angry, as bizarre as that is. A great evolutionary shift occurs when we notice that we're angry. I'm angry, and acknowledge it. It opens up a space in which some measure of detachment takes place. And the same process works for attachment and apathy as well. So once becoming aware of it, we create a space. And it's kind of a labeling thing. Sometimes some of us label thoughts as they arise as a meditation technique, to label anger coming up or apathy coming up. That's a puts that on a pause, seems to me. You're already detached from, I am not my anger. Originally I may be, you know, it's so all-consuming. And then, hopefully, we can activate the opposite attributes. So the practices of generosity, kindness or compassion, and wisdom as the three antidotes to the three poisons. That's something we can do individually, and probably must also precede any action we want to take. In the interpersonal or collective sense, we first, it seems to me, have to make a decision, an informed decision, about whether it is necessary and appropriate to make a statement, to act outwardly. I mean, there may be situations in which it's too dangerous to do that. It may be not worth it to do it in some situations where you see something happening that seems to exhibit one or more of the three poisons. But once a choice is made that you'll do something or say something to that, it seems to me, then we have to go back to discern our own motives, checking for these within us, attachment, aversion, or apathy. Be able to activate the antidotes, so for example, to show compassion, at least within us, for those people with whom we're having a very strong disagreement or for whom we're seeing exhibiting poisonous behavior. We certainly want to avoid piling our poisonous behavior on their poison behavior, and we get huge conflagration of poisons, if that's a mixed metaphor. So the meta-meditation about recognizing, okay, so the QAnon bikey is also a human being. He shares a lot of things with me, and there's no, I would wish, I don't know what's behind it, but I would wish him the same things that I wish for myself. If possible, of course, then listen carefully and attentively to another point of view. It's all too easy. We all talk about other people living in bubbles, but of course we have our own bubbles all the time, too. So to really make an attempt to connect, but without necessarily agreeing with anybody. You might talk to somebody who's opposed to, if you're pro-abortion, to try to have a conversation about one, at least to understand, probably it's not going to result in changing anybody's mind. And assert, if appropriate, assert your own view, whatever it is, one that is not ego-based, but instead has been sort of cleansed through our acknowledgement of our own propensity to act on the basis of attachment, aversion, and apathy.